Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Saturday, everyone. And welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. My show is about celebrating. Celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists. And today we're going to celebrate a lot. We're going to celebrate music. We're going to celebrate Rana Prea. We're going to celebrate the fact that he has written a fabulous book. And I have the book right here, The Era I Almost Missed. Before I get to you, Ron, I want to, I grew up in the 1960s and 70s in South Carolina, watching 1960s and 70s television. And I arrived in New York in 1979. And I feel like I arrived just at the end of a wonderful era because I got a chance to meet some of my greatest idols. When I first came to New York, I mean, Gloria Swanson, going to dinner and being at parties with Faye Ray, believe it or not, Carol Channing, Celeste Holm. I'm talking about those artists from the world of theater and show business. But you rubbed elbows, worked with, got to know, called your friends, some of the greatest names in show business, Lionel Hampton, Louis Armstrong, Woody Herman, just to name a few, John Lennon, and they are all within the pages of this book. So first of all, thank you for being here today. And before we delve into this book, my show is all about celebrating. So I want to know, first of all, what are you celebrating today?
What am I celebrating today? I'm celebrating the fact that that we're still here, considering what's been going on.
Absolutely. Well, let's put things in perspective with where we are right now. The world, we are getting back in the swing of things, as they say. But the world did shut down on March 12th of last year. What did your calendar look like when everything shut down on March 12th last year?
Well, it's kind of strange. We were living on Long Island, as I talked about in great length in my book, for many years, decades, and we had started getting busy with my big band, and we had done some recordings, and we were also working a club in Jersey, in Montclair, New Jersey, called Trumpets. We had spent about 6 years there with my
Believe band. It or not, I've performed there,
and that became our home. And from there, we eventually, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but we eventually wound up working at Birdland. The band was doing well, and we had just finished our fourth performance at Birdland, and in addition to that, we were also doing a live TV show that we were co-hosting. Angela and I were co-hosting a live TV show, and so we decided to move back closer to the city. The commute was really getting tough. We moved, we're in Forest Hills now. And we were in the middle of all these great things then. I mean, really interesting things we've always wanted to do. I mean, live TV, you know, playing Birdland, you know, and performing with my big band. And then crash, you know, that was, mm-hmm. you know, it came to a crashing halt. So, but I think, in a way, I mean, it was a terrible, terrible thing we've all been through. But it gave me some real downtime to write the book, number one. But more than that, even before I wrote the book, I was going back and writing arrangements for my band and for Angela. We're planning on a new album when this whole thing is over and when we're able to get together with, you know, in the same room with mm-hmm. my band members. So we're working on that. So I wound up writing about 30 new arrangements. And
good for you.
And I've been busy, mostly writing. And unfortunately for me, I stayed busy during this period writing, doing a lot of writing, whether it be the book or writing arrangements. I even have a dear friend of mine on the West Coast, Ted Sisler. Hopefully he's watching. He's a good singer and he has a publishing company and we're dear friends. And I've been writing music for him too. And so I've been busy, you know, not doing a whole lot of playing, but I've been busy writing.
Now you bring her up, so we're going to go there. For those who don't know, Angela is your gorgeous wife. So let's talk about her for a moment. You've been together pretty much 24/7 for the last year and a half. And, you know, what's that experience been like? Obviously, you work together and now you really have been forced to be together because of COVID. What has that experience been like for the two of you? And she is free to scream out if she wants to from the back.
She's right in the first row here. She's got a great seat here. fortunately, Angela, like me, can work from the house. She's also a voiceover artist, and she does a lot of work doing voiceovers. And we have a little studio right here in our co-op. So she's been quite busy doing her voiceovers. We both missed the performance, of course, but fortunately, we can and have been busy, you know, doing other things that we love doing and things that are productive mm-hmm. and paying us as well. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool. So we've been probably two of the more fortunate people in this whole mess, but doesn't mean we're not going crazy.
Now, you know, I think of this time frame that we've all gone through as a pause. I think of it as time for us to think about those things that matter to us the most. We've all lost a lot of things in our lives. Some people have lost their jobs. We've lost friends. Anything. What has this time frame taught you about yourself in terms of the things that perhaps you've taken for granted? I think all of us before on March 11th, let's go back there, took for granted that we were going to have gigs the following week, or that we were going to go to jobs and all those things were going to be in place for us. What are some of the things that you took for granted in your life that you never think that you'll take for granted again?
Wow, there's probably hundreds, you know. Just going to a restaurant, you know, going to a movie, going to a club, hugging a friend.
Well, I want to go back. You and I actually sat down and spoke several years ago. When you had written, I mean, you had created this phenomenal CD. I want to tell everyone, if you don't have it, go out and get it. It was your homage to John Lennon. You would put this great arrangements together. And I, at that time, was writing a blog. I liked this much better. And you and I sat down and we talked at that time. What I really got a sense of at that moment was this wonderful sense of recall that you had. And then reading this book, the memories that you have are all there. Have you always kept journals, or is it truly a sense of recall that you have? And how have you been able to compile all this together? And I want to talk a little bit about the process of this book, because as I have said to both you and Angela, there are so many layers to this book that I would like to try and dissect today.
Well, yeah, actually, I didn't keep notes. I really didn't. We were just talking about this earlier today. For some reason, I can picture everything that's in that book. I still see all those events. I had trouble, honestly, with the dates. putting the dates for me was a little bit more tricky. Fortunately, a lot of my old videos and movies and even some of my old photographs had dates on them, so that helped. But it was getting the dates that was the hard part. The stories I see very clear. Who knows why? I have no idea why I can see these things, but I kind of relived my whole darn life, you know. And I never really tried before. I never sat down and tried to write my and any of these memoirs. So it was an interesting experience, and one kind of led to another. You know, I tell other friends of mine, geez, I love your book and I want to write a book too. But how do you remember all these stories? Just start writing and one leads to another.
Well, you know, I am a firm believer that everybody has a story to tell. And obviously you have an amazing story to tell. But, you know, it's one thing to have a story to tell, and it's another thing to commit to tell that story. What was the spark that inspired you to really sit down and tell this story?
The lady in the first row here.
Thank you, Angela.
she kept kicking me. I didn't say, who wants to hear these stories besides you? She said, they're great stories. And she kept pushing me to, it was really, she really inspired the book.
And where did you begin with the stories? Did you write in a linear fashion, or did you just write memories as they were coming to you and then put them in a linear fashion?
I did a little of both. Sometimes the chronological order worked better. And then there were other times I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, gee, I forgot about this story. And I'd sit down and plug it in. So there was no exact way, you know, there was no system. I didn't have any kind of a system. I just let the back door open and I just let everything flow. And whatever came out, I wrote down. And sometimes it was in order, sometimes it wasn't.
Well, I really love this sense of, first of all, let's go back to your childhood. We really get a sense of your childhood and growing up in Queens and getting this sense of your life and your family. And God bless your mom and her love of music and introducing you to this and the fact that your parents were there. But I also think of the mistakes and the errors in your life. And when I say mistakes, I put it in quotation marks because I don't think there are any mistakes. I think the things that happened along the way were the things that were supposed to happen. And we will talk about those in just a moment. But I want you to take, for those who have not read the book, and our goal is to get people to get this book, is to take everybody back to the 5-year-old Ron Apria. Because to me, that is the pure self. Before you start school, before peer pressure begins to get added on, before teachers start deciding who you should be or who you shouldn't be, tell us a little bit about that 5-year-old boy.
I think I was kind of lucky to have been raised in the neighborhood that I was raised in this little patch of Astoria, which really wasn't representative of most of Queens or Astoria. It was kind of off the center kind of a place, 33rd Avenue and kind of down near Vernon Boulevard near the corner of Astoria, and it was a mixed area. All my friends, in fact, just about every one of my friends was African-American. There was some, although it was a mixed area, there were white families. It just so happened that the kids my age all happened to be African-American. These were my friends. And behind my house was kind of set in the middle of this block, you know, stories all blocks. And right in the middle of the block, there was an alleyway that would take you to my house. And so my house was kind of close to the street behind us. And on that street behind us was a Baptist church, and they would sing gospel music all day long on Sundays. And of course, no air conditioning in them days, and our windows were open in the summertime, and the music from the church would come right into my kitchen. So that I think I don't know why did I like gospel music? I have no idea, except that it resonated with me. And I think that was probably the foundation of where it all started for me. That and being exposed to some of the great big bands of the 40s. My mom would take me to the Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. In the days, they would have live shows all the time. And between the movies, there would be a live show. And I would sit there listening to these wonderful big bands and these brass sections and the energy and the life that was coming out of this. I said, man, that's what I want to do. It's just so loaded with good vibes and happiness, you know?
Well, you know, throughout your book, you also, I mean, you bring this up now and I want to go there. There was no, I mean, divisiveness. It's music brings us all together. Color barriers or anything. It's outside of music that those color barriers exist. When were you first aware of racism and that you were first dealing with this? That you tell this amazing story in the book of your wonderful friendship with your foster and you waiting for him to come one night to a rehearsal that he had promised to come to. And he was not able to get there because he was not able to get a cab. And you weren't even, it was something that you would never even cross your mind. Was that the first time that you'd ever thought about that? Was this something that had ever entered your consciousness before then?
It actually entered my consciousness before that, probably in high school. Is when I realized that there was such a thing as a racial problem. There was certainly none of that in my neighborhood, and there was no internet in them days, and you knew about your immediate surroundings, and my immediate surroundings there was none of that. You know? So I was a little bit surprised when I saw the depth of the racism problem. So I knew about racism, but I still didn't connect it to Frank Foster because Frank Foster, to me, you don't even think about people's skin color when you idolize everything they do. I was surprised that night when he didn't show up at my rehearsal and broke my heart, I was.
And then he called you to apologize the next day. You know, when he explained to you his reasons for not being able to be there. I mean, it really tugged at my heart reading this in the book, because again, I mean, and it's still something that's still going on to this day. I was watching a documentary recently. Broadway Beyond the Golden Age, and Broadway actors that were starring in Ain't Misbehavin' on Broadway would leave the theater signing autographs at night and then would have to take the subway home because they couldn't get a cab after getting standing ovations on Broadway.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that we're talking about this because I've done a bunch of interviews and a lot of people have read the book. And no one but you has asked me about that.
Wow.
I'm happy that I was able to, just get this off my chest in a way.
Well, I'm glad that you addressed this in the book. I want to talk about that first era in your career, which was a very important one. And that was going from your watching. I grew up like you watching the Lawrence Welk show. I watched it with my grandparents Myron Florin, and the instrument that you wanted to play. If you can take us there.
Sure. I used to love watching Pete Fountain. My parents loved watching the Lawrence Welk show. That, mm-hmm. that might have been one of the first real big band musical shows on TV. I mean, he kind of started the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But the music, although I appreciated the musicianship and how precise that band was, the style of the music didn't really impress me that much. Coming from, you know, watching the Dorsey band or Louis Prima's band or some of those great swing bands, I wasn't totally knocked out with the Lawrence Welk band. But I did enjoy the show mainly because he would bring out Pete Fountain, who was a clarinet player, a wonderful Dixieland clarinetist. Mm-hmm. And I could not wait for Pete to come out and start playing. He just made me feel so darn good. And I wanted to play the clarinet. I wanted to be like Pete Fountain. I remember in just about the seventh grade in middle school, we called it junior high school, I guess, in them days, mm-hmm. Mr. Cahill, my music teacher, said he had some instruments that were still available for rental. I think it was like $3 a month or something. And so I went home and I asked my mother if it'd be okay if I rented an instrument. And he said he had some saxophones left. And I'm picturing the clarinet.
I love it.
What do I? So my mother says, she thinks about it. She says, sure, that might be a good idea. You want to play an instrument? Yeah, for $3 a month. Sure, we can do that. So next day in school, Mr. Cahill asks again, and I raise my hand for the saxophone. And he says, stay after class. He takes me into a room, and he pulls out, opens a closet, and he pulls out all these big, smelly saxophone cases. And he's opening them up. I'm thinking, like, where's the saxophones? And I'm looking, waiting to see a clarinet. Now I'm embarrassed, and now I realize, I had the wrong instrument. I meant the clarinet, and I did realize it, but a little late. And I was too embarrassed to tell him that I didn't know the difference between a clarinet and a saxophone, so I took the saxophone home. And that's how my saxophone career got started, by a stupid mistake.
But, you know, you literally also could have gone into a baseball career if you didn't literally get hit with a curveball right in the eye.
Yeah, I wish it was a curveball. It was a fastball.
Yes. I considered a curveball because it took you off course.
Yeah.
That literally changed the direction of your life.
Yeah, it did. I had aspirations to be a baseball player. I loved baseball. I still do. I still love watching baseball. I played a lot of sports, and baseball was kind of my favorite sport. I was a pitcher, and I had a really bad accident one day. I was actually pitching a no-hitter, and the batter fouled off one of my fastballs, and it went over the backstop and into a park across the street. So one of the players on the other team, and I'll never know if he was trying to be helpful or if he was trying to hurt me, but he went and retrieved the ball and fired it back, and I already had another ball in my hand. The umpire had given me another ball. I was facing the outfield, and I hear, "Hey, pitcher!" And I turn around, and bam! I mean, it was like, you know, I could still feel that, as I'm telling you. And I was blind for about a month.
Mm-hmm.
We lost our pitcher here.
No, I'm still here. Just keep talking. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
No, I'm still here. So it may be one of those glitches.
All right.
Okay. I can still see you.
You can still see me. So
yes. Good. Yes.
So I lost sight in my left eye.
And, so I mean, here we are talking about losing sight in your left eye, and then you lose sight of me completely. So
right on cue.
Yeah, right on cue.
The engineer's here trying to.
Yeah,
things.
The engineer. That's me.
Yeah, but I can see you and hear you perfectly.
It should be right there. There you go.
Here we go. All right, we're
okay.
Back.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah, it was kind of hairy for a while. I there was a good chance I could have lost sight in both eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Internal hemorrhaging, and you know, it was really hairy for a while. But fortunately, it clotted. I had internal hemorrhaging and eventually clotted, and my eyesight came back, and it was kind of, the doctors admitted, I mean, they told me later, they said, it's kind of a miracle that I got my sight back. But that kind of ended, the field, not that I, it physically affected my playing, but I was always trying to figure out what I wanted to do, more music or baseball. Both were a long shot, I thought. That was kind of the deciding factor for me after that. I pitched.
Well, let's talk about when the music went from being, and maybe it never was a hobby for you, but when it, that shift from going from a hobby to being, this is what I have to do with my life. Can you take us there? And the actual, if there's some defining moment for you that happened for you?
I think from the first time I picked up a saxophone, I think I wanted to do that mm-hmm. all my life from the very beginning. And even things that preceded that, when I would listen to these great bands at the Paramount Theater and other places, and when I would go to that Baptist church from time to time, didn't sit in front of that beautiful choir. I couldn't imagine being happy doing anything else. That was really, I think musicians that are, and if any musicians, and I'm sure they are watching this.
I'm sure. There are several singers. I'm watching. I see some of the names, great singers, you know, musicians watching now.
Well, they know what I'm talking about. It's just something, you know, chooses you, I kind of feel. You know?
Absolutely. But where did that ambition come from for you at a very early age? I mean, in the book, once again, you talk about, I mean, and again, I have to say, you are an amazing writer, and you really take us there. As I'm reading the book, I see this movie going through my head. Mm-hmm. I think this would make Ken Burns, if you're listening, it would make a great docuseries. But you, you know, when you describe, for example, that first time that you put on a jacket and you're sitting with a big band and the feeling of sitting with a big band and being surrounded by these other musicians, you take us as the reader right into that moment. So that was always there. But where do you feel that ambition came from?
I don't know. You know, I tried to trace that back. There's no one event that I can think of where it could happen. I just think some people are born to do certain things, you know. I don't know if there was any, and I can't think of any one instance that they say, okay, I have to be a musician. I think we're all born with certain things that are just there. Who knows how they get there? You know, I don't know.
Well, as you're writing a book, Ron, I mean, I'm sure that there are many things. I mean, maybe Angela was your editor. Maybe you were your own editor. Maybe you had an outside editor. I don't know. But as you're editing this book and you're editing the episodes of your life, you choose what you want the reader to know or not know. Mm-hmm. Are there moments of your life that did not make it to the book? For example, in which you censored yourself? Because I get the sense, reading the book, that as you went through life, that you didn't censor yourself. If there was something that you wanted, that you went after it. If there was somebody that you wanted to meet, you asked for it. You mentioned in the book, you know, going to Birdland and, you know, and getting your photograph taken and asking to have your photograph taken with Frank Foster and all of these moments that happen. And it was like, along the way, this is what I want. And you asked for it. And, you know, if we all went through life like that, we would all be having the career that you had.
Yeah, well, I think at some point you have to figure out what it is you really, really want to do. Do you want to pursue this thing that you love, even though it doesn't make a whole lot of sense? I mean, music business is not, you know, it's not like being a doctor. Mm-hmm. An accountant or whatever, it can be tough, and we know this. And there are a lot of pitfalls. So, you know, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. And as much as we love it, can we really make a living out of this? Mm-hmm. So that's something that always crosses our minds. And I'm sure a lot of other musicians out there will agree. There are times when you wonder, like, what the heck am I doing? You know, I have a house and I have six mouths to feed. How the hell do we do this? There's a logical part of our brain, you know, that wonders.
But you also, I mean, you started very early on developing a great music library. I mean, you have the other sense of the business, and that's the business sense on the other side. And, you know, another musician started seeking you out for what you were able to accumulate and, you know, putting... let's talk for a moment for those musicians that are watching here. For you, what is the secret, or is there a secret, in terms of putting a great band together, putting a great orchestra together? It may seem simple on the surface. Obviously, you want great people who are going to come together, but there are different layers to it. And you get these sense, you know, reading the book again, of the great people that you've met along the way, the pluses, the minuses. You know, what are your secrets to putting a great band together?
All right. Well, my secrets to putting great bands together, it works for me. I always consider chemistry. You know, you can get a band full of all-stars and it can sound terrible. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the chemistry. I work really hard at finding people that are compatible with my music. People that are, because there are a lot of different directions, and there are a lot of different areas of even the jazz field itself. Whether it be Dixieland outside playing or high energy playing or bebop or whatever, hard bop that, So you have to figure out who the players are that are kind of grooving the same stuff that you are musically, and try to get, and then after that you have to figure out, well, personalities, you know, and can we get along, and so I try to surround myself with people. I'm not a leader who has an iron fist, and I don't stand up in front of my band and scream and. No, I'm more like a cheerleader, and I just surround myself with wonderful players who are nice, or friends of mine, people I love, and I cheer them on. Mm-hmm. And for me, that works the best.
I want to say one thing that I really admire about you, Ron. I had a conversation yesterday with someone about a new tell-all book that just came out. I'm not a fan of name dropping for the sake of dropping names, especially if you're dropping salacious aspects of someone's life or something. And that's not you. So kudos to you for that. Which each section that you've done with each of the great artists that you've had the pleasure of working with, you give a biographical accounting of who these people are. Which is also very, very important for people who don't necessarily know who these musicians are, which I thought was a great addition to your book. Whose idea was it to do that?
Okay, I'm going to be honest. it wasn't mine. I have a friend who lives on the West Coast. His name is Tad Sissel. I mentioned his name before.
Yes, he's in the book. Yeah,
he has his own publishing company, and I met him through a book that he published. A dear friend of mine, Steve Madeo, and he sent me Steve's autobiographical book, mm-hmm. and we became friends. So when I was writing these memoirs, I contacted him and asked him if he might be interested, and he said send me the book and let me take a look at it. And he did, and he loved it. And I said, wow, somebody besides me likes this, you know, because you always wonder. It's the same feeling, you know, I've produced a lot of records. And there's always that fear that no one but you is going to like it. You know, it's like, I like it, but will anyone else? So when Tad said he liked it, I think, wow, this is great. And it was his, by the way, it was his idea to put a paragraph about each of these people. That I worked
with. Brilliant. So, you know, brilliant idea.
So I thank him. Thank you, Tad Sisler.
Yeah, so, well, you bring up a very interesting point. When you are creating an album, or in this case, this book, are you thinking as you are writing this about who the ultimate audience is as you're doing this?
No. I honestly wasn't. I was just writing, trying to get these stories out of my head and onto paper. I wasn't really thinking about an audience, and the funny thing is, I wasn't doing this to make any money. If I didn't sell a book, it would have been okay.
Bad idea in this business if that's your ultimate goal.
Angela wanted me to write my memoirs, and I did. And the fact that we ordered 100 books, and like in 3 weeks they were gone. I was in shock. People are actually buying these things. Mm-hmm. You know? So I wasn't really thinking about an audience. I was thinking, I guess musicians are going to be more interested in this, and people in the entertainment field will be more interested than people who aren't. But I didn't know. I have no idea. And some people, who bought the book, who are not in the entertainment field, and they loved it. So so apparently there's some stories in there that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you know, there are.
I wasn't consciously targeting an audience or anything.
What was your process like when you were writing the book? Were there specific times each day that you sat down to write the book, or did you write as you got an inspiration? What was the actual process?
Actually, I think 90% of the time I would wake up. It was in the middle of this pandemic. You know, I've been getting up kind of early these days. And I'd wake up in the morning. I found the morning was the best time for me. And I'd sit down, you know, pull up my computer and start typing. And I'd go maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours.
Wow.
And then I'd have Angela would come in. Angela's, she used to be a reading teacher. She's a great reader. And she would come in and read it back to me. And that's how I was able to kind of shape it. You know, I'd hear it coming back, and I said, okay, maybe I'll put this word here, change that, move this, and then we'd move things around a little bit. But the secret was, like, I would just sit down and write all day, and then she would come in at the end of the day, right before dinner, and read it back to me. And that was the process. That was the system we used. And
Did you write in longhand? Did you write on a computer? How did you?
No, I was typing into the computer.
Okay. And was there a particular memory that you had forgotten completely that came back to you as you were writing?
Yeah, actually, there's a few that I thought about after the book was published that I should have included.
Well, there's going to be a part two.
We can only hope.
There'll be a follow-up. I'm sure there is. What surprised you or amazed you the most about yourself after you finished writing the book? And when did you know that the book was, for lack of a better word, completed?
There were a couple of times when I thought it was done, actually. And things came up that I had to put in the book. Very current things. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that book is right up to only a few months ago.
That's right.
It started back in 1940 something, whatever, 45, right up until 2021. So it covers an amazing span of years. There were a couple of times I thought it was done and it wasn't. And I'm almost afraid to talk about it because I'll get emotional. So.
Well, that's okay. I've had many people get emotional here. But you know, I want to talk about some of the people that are mentioned in the book. And again, we're not going to give away too much because I want people to read the book. But let's talk about some of these people that have made an impact on your life. I want to tell you that right after I came to New York, I was listening to WNEW radio one night, and I won a trivia contest, and I won two tickets to go to Roseland, and Woody Herman was playing, so I was able to go. He was, and Margaret Whiting was the female vocalist that night. As I said, totally at the end of that era, so I was lucky enough to be there. What are some of the life lessons that you learned from Woody Herman, whether they be in the book or not?
So Margaret Whiting, didn't they call her Leather Lungs?
Yes.
Was that her nickname? Yeah.
Yes.
We actually did a couple of shows and followed her in this club here on Long Island. But better give me that question one more time.
Yeah, what are some of the life lessons that you learned from Woody Herman?
Gee, I don't know. I don't know if I had any life lessons learned from Woody Herman, but it's like I don't know. That's a tough one, Richard. Yeah. Well, it's not even a life lesson, but it was something that occurred when I was at Woody Herman's band that might be of interest for people to know. Before I joined Woody Herman's band, I was having a little bit of a tough time with the instrument that I was playing. I had this gold-plated Selma saxophone. It was an old one. They called it a cigar cutter. And the old saxophones were a little bit harder to play in tune. The intonation wasn't quite as good as some of the newer instruments. But it was a beautiful horn. It had a beautiful tone to it, and the action was really nice. And I just loved the sound I was getting out of it. But the pitch started bothering me a little bit. I was doing some record dates, and I was fighting the pitch a little bit too much. So I decided to, and I didn't have enough money to buy a second horn. So I traded it in for a newer horn that was a little bit easier for me to play in tune. And shortly after that, I got a call to play with Woody's band. And we were somewhere in the Midwest, and Woody never rode with the band. He would always drive his Corvette. He had a Corvette, and I don't know how the heck he did that, because we would sleep on the bus. And when did he sleep? So he would drive to the gigs through the night, and then so I'm on the bandstand before one of our concerts, and I see his horn. His band manager, Bill Byrne, would set up everything and put the instrument up on a stand right in front of the sax section. And I see this gold horn, and I say, what the heck kind of horn is that? And I walk over to it. Make a long story short, it's my horn. So I said, I got to ask Woody, how the heck did he get my saxophone? So when he got to the theater, we started talking, and I told him the story about, and I knew it was my horn, because I had put these cork lifters on the upper palm case, and then I covered them with nail polish so that they wouldn't wear down. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I saw those red corks, and I looked at the horn. I picked up the horn. Sure enough, that was my horn. But anyway, the story is his horn got ripped off and on tour, and he called Links and Longs and said, send me the best alto you have. And I had just traded it in at that point.
Oh, my God.
So they sent him my horn. And that horn today is in the Smithsonian Institute.
That's amazing. What a great story.
Yeah.
Yes, that's wonderful. When you and I spoke, for the blog, we met and talked because of your album on John Lennon. If you can, you know, again, I'm going to ask you the same life lessons you learned from John Lennon that might surprise some people.
I think the thing that surprised me the most was how how should I put it? How nice a guy he was. I mean, he was a sweetheart, almost shy. You know, mm-hmm. and very almost even like he would give us an example of what he wanted us to play because we had no music for that session. And we were kind of all putting our heads together, John and the five of us. But before we would even start recording, John would try to explain the groove he wanted, and he would try to play it on his guitar. And he was always apologizing about his guitar playing. And I was always thinking, like, don't apologize. You're John Lennon, man. You know, you don't have to apologize for your playing. Are you kidding me? But he was so humble. I think that was the thing that surprised me the most. What a sweet guy this guy was. And he certainly didn't have to be. I mean, he was paying us a lot of money, and he could have been the nastiest guy in the world. We would have still been there. But that was just not him. I think I should probably tell you this story. You may know it, but I'm sure a lot of people don't know this story. Since he didn't have arrangements, he had lead sheets, and I wanted to make copies of those lead sheets to hand out to the horn players. There were five horn players on that session. So I got his lead sheets and I went into another room to photostat them so that we would have at least a guide. We would know where the melody was. We would know what the chords are and the form of the tune we were going to be working on. It would make it a lot easier for me and everybody else. So I decided to do these photostats. And while I'm photostatting the music, John comes walking into the room and sticks his face in the photostat machine and hits the button. And two blinding lights later, a couple of photostats come sliding out. And I mean, Steve and I were in the room. We both went like this, like, what the heck? It was blinding. And his face was right in there. And I'm thinking, what is he thinking? What's he doing? He's risking his sight to have fun. I didn't get it. So the photostats come out, and he hands one to Steve, and he hands one to me. And he says, hang on to these. He says, these are going to be worth something someday, you know. And he walks out, and Steve and I are looking at each other like, what just happened?
So where is it? So where do you keep it?
It's on my wall. It's hanging right here in my.
You told me this story when we spoke the last time, when I interviewed you a couple of years ago. So I remember that story. I want to ask you, I'm all about celebrating, so I'm going to ask you a question. And I don't want you to give a name or a circumstance that will give this away. But what was the lowest point that you got that you had to get through in this business, and what got you through it, whether it be spirituality or prayer or just sheer determination? I ask this question for those who are watching it, who are maybe going through a low point in their own lives right now. If you can just tell us about a low point in the business that you had to get through and what got you to the other side of that.
Okay, well, aside from the pandemic, we'll put that one aside. There were so many. I mean, there were a lot of ups and downs in this business. Wait, this girl in the first row, she has an answer.
You always told me that the night that you went to the lobby and heard music, that was the turning point. You told your boss basically you're quitting the insurance business.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I had a few day gigs over the years. The economy was just at a point, and the gigs weren't. I wasn't feeling secure about being able to support my family. And going have to work a day job. I drove a soda truck, you know. That's a pretty low point for me. I mean, I was driving a Hoffman soda truck, you know, in the South Bronx. You know, actually it was Dr. Brown's soda. Mm-hmm. That had to be one of my lower points. Mm-hmm. I would think. I felt when you do stuff like that, you know, you're paying your bills and you're taking care of the financial part, but you feel like you're about 1,000 miles away, and you wonder, like, am I still going to be able to pick up my saxophone and make music when this thing's over? You know, and you just wonder, are you still going to be able to make music? You know, when you're throwing these soda cases down the basements of these delis, you know, So yeah, those are probably some of my lowest points, I would think.
Well, but you got through it. So Ron, we are going to run out of time, but I always in my shows, you know, one of my favorite series on TV was Inside the Actor's Studio, that was on Bravo with James Lipton, who was watching down on me, I hope. And he always ended his show with a list of questions. So these are just some random questions just for the fun of it. And I'm going to ask you these questions that they're random. What part of the business, show business, fascinates you the most today?
Show business. I don't know. I still love Broadway shows. You know, I'm trying to think of the last show that Anza and I went to that I really loved. Jersey Boys. We really enjoyed that. Yeah. There's very little in the entertainment world that I'm not a fan of.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate good acting, good dancing, you know, a good movie.
You know. That's great. And you may have already answered this next question, but what time of day do you most appreciate or need silence?
I don't know if I ever need silence. I don't know if I like silence.
So, well, I was going to ask you, you know, what music do you currently listen to? I mean, what was the last bit of music that you were listening to prior to this show?
Most of my music, I love vocals. My wife's a singer and
a great singer, I might add.
Yeah, and even prior to meeting Anza, my mom was a good singer. And of course, we talked about the gospel choir. So I was always sensitive to vocals, good singers. I loved listening to Ray Charles, and I loved listening to Ella, and I loved listening to Sinatra. I love Benny Goodman's big band.
Mm-hmm.
I loved listening to Basie's band, Duke Ellington's band. So I love Dixieland. I have a wide range of my favorite music is probably a swing and big band, you know, which is what I'm still doing and still, you know, trying to get my music out there.
That's great.
But I love pretty much different. I'll cross genres and I'm not just listening to jazz or just listening to vocals. If I hear a good pop singer or whatever, if it's happening and it'll move me, you know, and I'll get a good vibe from it, you know. But my preference is probably big band jazz.
Okay. And what is the silliest thing that you own?
Wow. Throwing these things at me. Silliest thing that I own. Holy smokes. Let me think about that. Let's go on. Let me think about that. We'll come back to that because I own a lot of silly things.
Okay. You said to me in our last interview that you love to build things. You're a creator. What is your most treasured possession?
I have
the answer to that one.
My most treasured possession might be that Lennon photostat we talked about.
That's great.
And the funny part is, at the time, it was very insignificant to me. I was so preoccupied with getting that music right. I was really worried about that session because there was no music, and not only were we working with five horns and no music, but we were in a genre of music that I wasn't really comfortable with. I wasn't a rocker, you know. I just come off the road with Lionel Hampton's band, I was worried about that session. I was worried about getting through it without sounding like a jerk. So when he gave us those photostats, I just rolled it up and stuck it in my case. Probably a day or two after that, I looked at it and I said, wow, this is pretty cool. And as it turns out, that's probably my most prized possession, I think. I love that photostat.
Wow, that's great.
And the story that goes with it. You know?
That's wonderful. What is the wildest thing that you've ever done in your career?
The wildest thing. It doesn't have to have anything to do with music.
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, I was in Sandusky, Ohio with Les Elgart's band. And I think this might have been one of the first, what do they call it? It's not a bungee cord, but it's like you climb up the top of this mountain and there's a cable that runs right across the lake and you hook this pulley on it and you hang on and you swing. That might have been the craziest thing I've
Would you do it again?
No. No, I couldn't wait till I hit the water, man. I said, that's it. What was I thinking about?
This is again James Lipton. What is the worst word anyone ever used to describe you?
Gee whiz. I don't know. I have to think about that one too. The worst word anybody ever used to describe me. I can't think of one. I don't know if
anything. That's good. I like that you can't think of one. What would you most like to change in your career?
What would I like to change in my career? I would like to maybe change my approach, maybe to certain situations, maybe be a little bit more open-minded to other genres of music, possibly, but the change, I don't know, maybe in, I always think about, and I guess maybe a lot of musicians think of this too, I'm always thinking about another area of music that I might want to get into. Maybe I should try this more, maybe I should play more like this, maybe I should try play more modern, maybe I should add forts or whatever. I'm never 100% sure. And I envy, especially jazz musicians. I envy jazz musicians who are comfortable with what they're doing, and they just sound like they're very happy and very comfortable. I never feel like I'm comfortable. I'm always looking for something else. I'm always trying to do something else, or try to explore this, or maybe I should do more of that, or try this. Or I'm never as comfortable as I would like to be, and as I see many other people are. So I'm a little bit restless when it comes to, what I want to do and how I want to express myself. You know.
Okay. And my last question: who is the person who most deserves to be rewarded for something?
Other than my wife?
Well, I was hoping that you were going to say that.
I think Frank Foster. I think Frank Foster was very underrated.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah,
Based on what I've read, I would agree with you.
When people talk about great arrangers and great tenor saxophone players, he was a great tenor saxophone player too. That kind of got overshadowed with the fact that he was such a great arranger and that he was such an important member of the Count Basie band. He's linked with the Count Basie band by most people. And that was only part of his career. And after he left Basie, boy, he did some amazing things that I don't think he got enough credit for.
Wow. Well, Ron, don't go anywhere for a moment. I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank all of you for being here. First of all, I'm sure I can speak for Ron when I say this, I don't take it for granted that you could have been anywhere else for the last hour. The fact that you chose to spend it with us, I don't take for granted, so thank you. And if this was your first time here at Richard Skipper Celebrates, my hope is that you will subscribe and that you will check out some of the other shows. This happens to be our 301st episode. So that's quite a milestone. There are a lot of other celebrities and artists that we've celebrated behind us. And we have a lot of great people that we're going to be celebrating ahead of us. So please check those out. Hit the like button if you did indeed like today's show. Leave a comment. That helps to elevate the show. And please tell your friends. Let them know about the show as well. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. This is what I would like all of you to do today. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the second name that pops up, I want you to reach out to that person, not with a Facebook, with a friend, with an email or a text message or a private message, but a phone call. And you're going to let that person know what they mean to you. And then you're going to go to Ron's website, which is right here below. And you are going to order two copies of this book. You're going to keep one copy for yourself, and you're going to send the other copy to that friend that you just called, because they're going to appreciate it, and Ron's going to appreciate it, and I'm going to appreciate it. And then you're going to let Ron know what you think of the book, and you're going to let me know what you think of the book. Now, I'm going to leave the screen right now, and I'm going to give Ron the entire screen to himself. And Ron, you've got the final word. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about today that you want to expound upon, anything that you that we didn't talk about that you wish that we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now. Ron, I thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world, the gifts that you will continue to give thanks to your music and thanks to this book. Angela, thanks for all your help today. And you're the gift that keeps on giving. Thank you. You've got the final word.
Who is an amazing human being and a total pro. It's been such a pleasure to sit here and talk with Richard for the past hour. I have total respect for what Richard does. And I think in these crazy times that hopefully will be ending soon. I just want to, from Angela and me, we just want to send all love to everyone out there, and wish everybody safe times and better times, and again, thank you, Richard, for this opportunity. This was wonderful, and I really enjoyed sitting here and talking about my life, which is something I never dreamed I'd be doing. But thank you so much for this.